The Flood, Commentary for the April 23rd, 2022 Sabbath School Lesson by Stephen Terry, Director, Stillwaters Ministry, www.visitstillwaters.com. Every living thing that moved on land perished. Birds, livestock, wild animals, all the creatures that swarm over the earth, and all mankind. Everything on dry land that had the breath of life in its nostrils died. Every living thing on the face of the earth was wiped out. People and animals, and the creatures that move along the ground, and the birds were wiped from the earth. Only Noah was left, and those with him in the ark. Genesis 7, verses 21 through 23. The flood brings us to a conundrum when examining the stories of Genesis. It tells us that only 8 individuals survived a global catastrophe, but also tries to explain what happened prior through that very narrow lens. It is like a child playing with a cardboard tube as though it were a telescope and pointing it at something to view. While what is seen through the tube may be clear, it represents little of the actual world around the child, and attempting to reconstruct a holistic view of the world from that limited perspective will be an effort fraught with assumptions and errors. Nonetheless, this is all that Genesis offers us. Though necessarily vague, clues abound that are frustratingly tantalizing while offering little that is concrete. Some acknowledging that the antediluvian world was saturated with a miasma of evil feel it is better that all of that remains lost on the other side of that narrow opening, while others, hoping for clues to explain why we are what we are today, would try to pry that opening further ajar to better understand those enigmatic clues. Last week I mentioned apocryphal works, the Book of Enoch and the Book of the Giants, that mention intercourse between fallen angels and humankind that produced demigods, and miscegenation between those fallen angels and beasts that produced the monsters of old. We can add the Book of Jubilees discovered at Qumran as another source for this kind of information. The fact that these books were seen to be credible by ancient worshippers, coupled with similar legends in other cultures' myths, argues strongly for a still earlier source for these ideas. But lest we are tempted to relegate all of this to the ignorance of primitives, as Seventh-day Adventists, we are faced with Ellen White's statement about one of the contributing factors to the evil that permeated society prior to the flood. She wrote, "But if there was one sin above another which called for the destruction of the race by the flood, it was a base crime of amalgamation of man and beast, which defaced the image of God and caused confusion everywhere." What she wrote here is vague and has been highly controversial, especially in the United States, for it was written in the historical context of the enslavement of black people and their emancipation. Some have felt that the various skin colors and ethnic features were vestiges of antediluvian evil that somehow were carried forward despite the narrow corridor of the ark. Those who sought justification for racial superiority clung to passages like these as proof of such nonsense. These kinds of arguments also claim that the mark God placed on Cain after he killed his brother was racial, with a curse attached. This is despite the mark, whatever it might have been, was not a curse, but an act of grace to lessen the impact of Cain's curse. The flood story is schizophrenic, as we are given 2 slightly different accounts. We are first told that Noah is to bring 2 of every kind of animal, male and female, onto the ark to preserve the various species from the flood. But later we are told he was to bring 2 of each unclean animal and 7 of each clean animal. It is as though an ancient editor confronted with the earlier account started asking questions. If there are only 2 of each species, how will we continue sacrifices without causing the extinction of species? They may have also asked, once the flood had abated, What will people eat since the vegetation was destroyed? Increasing the number of some species from 2 to 7 answered both questions. If the distinction was based on the lists of the clean and unclean in Leviticus chapter 11, we can assume a religious and dietary need for this change in the number of animals brought into the ark. Cultural myths are often infused with magical thinking that does not take such needs into account, so it remains for later writers to bring practicality to the narrative. Sometimes this works and sometimes it does not, and provides a foundation for lifelong careers for apologists who take it upon themselves to attempt to reconcile everything through facile, if not imaginative, accounts that it all works if we do not look behind the curtain. They base these constructs on the idea that faith itself will fail if everything cannot be explained. But then if everything can be explained, is it really faith? And what happens if we accept the apologist's explanation and, resting comfortably in our trust of that construct, we find a flaw and the entire structure collapses? How do we respond? Do we find another person who has a believable explanation? Or do we, as so many, give up in frustration and abandon faith entirely? This is a dilemma for those who hold Genesis to be literally true. Truth, by definition, does not contradict itself. Therefore, an explanation must be possible. But this thinking also brings contradiction. How can a text that claims to be divinely inspired by an ineffable being ever be completely understood by flawed humanity? And to add to the complexity of the issue, how can flawed humanity ever record such divinely inspired ideas without creating errors in the first place? These are familiar problems to those trained in the examination of ancient texts. I was privileged to study textual criticism under the gifted theologian Sakai Kubo, Dean of Theology at Walla Walla College, and author of A Reader's Greek-English Lexicon of the New Testament. One of the most important lessons I learned there was not to idolize the text, but instead to go beyond the text and any flaws it might contain, to seek out the ineffable God behind it all. In the words of Fox Mulder of the X-Files, the truth is out there. We can vainly wait for it to be served to us on a silver platter, or we can go and search for it. God and truth both must be sought after. As the prophet Jeremiah wrote, "You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart," Jeremiah 29:13. If they coexist, as I have come to believe, then truth anywhere, in any discipline, should reveal something about God. Despite what some would have us believe, truth is not limited to the Bible. But with the Bible, once we can see past literalness to the metaphors, a whole new understanding opens, able to see past the contradictions. For instance, without explicit details about angel, human, and animal anatomy, we can understand that conditions prior to the flood story were an existential threat to all. Every time we consign someone to prison for life without parole, we show we understand how this can be and the level of evil that necessitates such drastic responses to keep others safe. Every time we read that vague account of the antediluvian world, we cannot help but look around and ask ourselves, how does our present situation compare? Every life that is taken, every human being who is trafficked and enslaved, tells us that it is possible for evil to become that pervasive again. The life that has not been touched by it is exceedingly rare. The flood story tells us that it is possible for evil to culminate in global destruction. It is that aspect of the story that is so compelling, not the animals or the ark, but the capability for evil to bring about the annihilation of everything we love and care about. But with the flood metaphor, God tells us that if those who are willing to change, to pass through the water of baptism to a new life, will be delivered. Sadly, the flood account also reveals how few really wanted that possibility. The number may be small today as well. The Noahic world was suddenly destroyed. Everyone was going about their normal lives until they were all swept away, unable or unwilling to respond to the predicted threat. Are we much different today? The earth is overcome with abuse and pollution. Every one of us carries in our bodies microplastics and PFAS chemicals that are with us for life, doing untold damage to our biological systems. Society tells us that we are all only winners or losers. Winners take all, and the losers have nothing but suffering. If a more powerful country wants what another country has, they simply take it, acting out on a national level what is happening increasingly often on our streets. While that ancient world was wiped out by water, with the United States and Russia having over 12,000 nuclear missiles between them, the possibility of an equally devastating global annihilation by fire seems more reality than metaphor. The power of the flood is that it challenges us to respond to overwhelming evil, rather than simply allowing the tide to carry us along, to be lost in the maelstrom, swallowing everyone else. We are encouraged to find our foundation in that ineffable God, even if we find it challenging to understand what comes to us when we do. What seems crazy today may well be the eventual vehicle of hope and deliverance in the face of unforeseen catastrophe. Thank you for listening to this podcast. You can find the written version of this podcast, as well as hundreds of other commentaries and many other podcasts, at our website at www.visitstillwaters.com. May God richly bless you and your family.